Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Greg Bresnitz.
And I'm Darren Bresnitz. We're the host of Snacky Tunes.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn.
If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Native on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Brianna Kurtz. Each week, this show features a U.S. or international location and uses food and drink as a gateway to explore and celebrate the cuisine and culture of a destination. Part travel show, part current affairs, this show takes the opportunity to examine the nuances that help define a place by using the eyes, ears, and taste buds of farmers, chefs, journalists, and the like. This week, I'm in Thailand, and today I'm talking to Andy Ricker, founder of the Pok Pok Enterprise. So, hi, Andy. Welcome. Thank you for being on Heritage Radio today.
My pleasure.
So, we are here in Chiang Mai, your other home, one of your many homes. So, how long do you get to spend each year in Thailand? Like, maybe, like, total?
Total, I think, probably about 3 months of the year over several trips.
Yeah. And, I mean, I'm assuming you're constantly inspired when you come here, every time learning more, learning something new. What's inspiring you on this trip?
Well, during these trips that I come at, I come at different times of the year. And the good thing about that is that as the seasons change, different products become available and different dishes become available. And every time I come, I end up finding something new. And sometimes it's not necessarily a dish. Sometimes it's just a product that I haven't seen before. Or, there's been an improvement on something. So, for instance, right now, it's strawberry season in Chiang Mai. And the strawberries grow in the mountains here. And in the past, most of the strawberries I've had have been really not good. Like, not sweet. Not very fragrant, kind of pale comparison to the Western ones. And, you know, I've had some of the strawberries lately. They've been really good, and I don't know whether they've found a new variety, but there's whole villages up in the mountains that are growing strawberries.
I saw some yesterday when I was walking around some of the markets. Now, I mean, the strawberries, though, you kind of just pop them in your mouth and just eat them. There's really nothing that goes into them to kind of, like, to manipulate them or turn them into a dish. It's more of just a satisfactory kind of...
Yeah, Thai people love to eat fruit, and they actually like when fruit's quite sweet. And so what they do is they bathe them in sugar often. You'll see a little cup at the market of chopped strawberries that are like bright red, and that's from being like bathed in sugar syrup, basically. I've been trying to convince some friends of mine here to pickle them, because they also, pickled fruit is a very long-standing tradition in Thailand. And the green strawberries would be delicious here pickled. Also noticed that there's some Cape gooseberries here that I hadn't seen before, and I've never had a Cape gooseberry. I've never had a Cape gooseberry before. Have you?
No.
They're got like a paper husk on them, the way a tomatillo does, but inside it's like yellow, gold yellow.
I've seen them. I know what you're talking about, but no, I haven't. You know what? I think I have had them, but they're pretty tart.
Tart and sweet, mm-hmm. And kind of like the consistency of a cherry tomato almost. Yep. Really, really good. So, you know, the thing about Thailand is that, you know, it doesn't exist in like a vacuum where nothing changes. There's constant influence from outside, agriculturally, culturally, culinarily. There's just constantly things happening and influencing the way people think, eat, art, all kind of design, everything. It's a very, it's not an insular country.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, I think that love of place, you're never consumed by one thing. It's not one dimensional. So is there, you know, besides the food, the design, the art, is there, you know, a spiritual element and attachment for you to this place?
Yeah, of course there is. I mean, I've been coming here since 1992. And there's a certain comfort that I have here that just comes from being here a lot. I also, you know, I've been here long enough and I've been around here long enough to realize that it's not all smiles and happiness. There's a lot of strife and political problems here, and life isn't easy for everybody here. But as a visitor, you know, that's the general impression. There's kind of a, especially up here in Chiang Mai, it's a very laid-back vibe. Generally speaking, you don't see people fighting in the streets, you know,
or yelling
at each other. Yeah, it's just a different vibe. You know, nobody honks their horn here. You know,
it's a little bit quieter. That's
you
for
live
sure.
in New York. It's just, you know, nobody takes offense to it. You just, that's how you get around. You fucking beep your horn, you know. And in Chiang Mai, you don't beep your horn. So it's a very relaxing place to be, even when you're busy. There's also a kind of that cliched, Thailand is a land of smiles, right, where everybody's friendly. And in Chiang Mai, it's not that everybody's friendly, but there's a certain, very famously people always talk about how, you know, people from New York are unfriendly and people from LA are really friendly. And of course, that's a cliche. It's not always true. And likewise, here in Thailand, the people of Thailand think, people in Chiang Mai are very jidi, very friendly, nice, helpful. And they think that people in Bangkok are too busy and not that friendly. And of course, again, that's really it's a cliche. That's not exactly true. But if you go to the market here in Chiang Mai and you walk around and you see something you're interested in, you stop and talk to the vendor and they'll say, here, try it, and it's a much more, just culturally, it's a more laid back friendly place to be.
Yeah, I definitely found yesterday when I was in the markets that either if I hung around long enough they would shove something into my hand, or if I asked to try something they'd be happy to. And those cliches that these positive images of a happy place and happy people, those aren't bad things. But do you think, and this kind of connects to a question I want to talk about with New York, where do you think those assumptions kind of come from? And do you worry that Chiang Mai might change into what people assume about Bangkok? I mean, it's the second largest city in Thailand. It's growing. Do you think someday that it might morph into more of that kind of Bangkok vibe?
I mean, it's going to get busier and busier, and it has. It's gotten more and more developed. There's been more and more people coming here from Bangkok. But, I mean, if that were true, then, L.A. would have turned into New York and vice versa. And I just think that cities keep their culture in some sort of form, more or less forever. And, I can't see Chiang Mai turning into Bangkok.
Well, it's kind of like I'm from the beach, and the beach vibe, no matter how touristy and the influx of businesses that come in, there's still always a beach vibe. Mm-hmm. It's still going to always be a beachy place. So, and up here in the north, the climate, the foliage, the a little bit more terrain that you get kind of in Bangkok definitely, I think, has an influence on like the vibe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
But I want to also talk about some of those assumptions. Well, before I left New York, I did a big project on looking at Thai restaurants in New York. So Adaya to Pak Pak to Zabi Lee to Santander, I could go on and on, and there's so many. And I was wondering, I'm like, okay, so I've really formed this image in my mind of what Thai food is, or what American Thai food is, or what Thai food in New York is. And I'm about to go to Thailand, and I'm about to find out how realistic is this? And I've kind of solidified in my mind as kind of like cuisine of the imagination. How close do you think we are to how we perceive things in the U.S. versus how they are here?
That's a pretty complicated question with a complicated answer. I can say that it really depends on who's doing the perceiving. If you're a Thai person, your perception is colored by your experience growing up. If you're a Western person living in the West, your perception is colored by your experience in the West before you come here. And you're looking for certain things. We're not I don't think it's in our nature to seek out the things that go against what we believe is true. We're looking for affirmation of what we believe is true. So when you come to Thailand and you've eaten in all these places, you're going to be looking for those same dishes, right? And you're going to be looking in places that are accessible to you. And if you're a Western tourist and you have no Thai reading skills, no Thai language skills, and you're having a go at it alone, you're going to have a complete fail pretty much. Because it's basically it's not transparent. You don't know what's going on. If you're lucky enough to have a Thai friend who takes you around, it gets a little bit better. But the thing is about Thai culture is the Thai people want you to have a good experience, right? They want you to enjoy your time here. They want you to come away feeling, wow, that was great. I love Thailand. So they're going to try to find something that they think will appeal to you. And it's an age-old problem with ending up in a restaurant where you end up eating something that you've had in the West because your Thai host thinks that's what you want. And, you know, for the most part, they're right. it's a safer gamble than taking you somewhere and, you know, giving you a dish that is perhaps outside of what they think we are able to eat. Not just like to eat, but are actually capable of eating. So that's very difficult. And if you're a Thai person, your experience revolves around where you grew up, who you ate with when you were young, who cooked for you. It's a very, very complicated sort of subject to get to the bottom of. And it's something I've spent a lot of time thinking about and trying to figure out. You know, when I first came back to the States, after being up here in Chiang Mai, I started looking for the food that I'd had here because I was lucky enough to get in with people who, you know, trusted that I was able to eat the food. So I was taken to eat, you know, very, very deep local stuff. And I went back to the States looking for it. It just wasn't there. And I couldn't figure out why. Why is this not here? And I'd ask Thai people and they, you know, oh, you know, I don't know. So I've made it my life's work to go ahead and go, well, you know, there's all this other stuff here. And it gets even more and more, the more you think about it, the more complex it gets, you know, and the more I think I know about it, the less I end up knowing about it.
It's endless.
It's endless, yeah. I mean, literally, there's, you know, take a dish like lab, right, one of my favorite dishes here. It changes from city to city, from town to town, from house to house, restaurant to restaurant, chef to chef. You know,
is it changing based on the protein that's being used or how it's being seasoned or how it's being cooked? Like, what is the
all of those
primary,
things.
All of them.
All of those things. I can give you an example.
So the nuances are very finite.
Yeah.
I mean, it gets...
Sure. I mean, it's you're talking about... I'll give you a little bit of a glimpse down the wormhole, so to speak. Just a regular lab made from pork. Okay, minced, cooked version of lab. There's essentially two versions of cooked lab. One's called lab kua, which means dry fried. Another one called lab suk, which means cooked all the way, but it's actually cooked in liquid. So those are the two basic versions of cooked lab. Now, in Chiang Mai, where we're close to the historic, you know, spice trail, you go to the markets here, and there's like, you know, thousands of spices that you can get your hands on. And you have been able to for a long time now. So the typical prick lab or spice mixture for lab can have up to 20 different things in it here. You get a little further away from Chiang Mai, you get to Nan province or Pra, something like that. And the you know, the way that they spice it changes so that there's maybe only four things in it. Mak Hwen, Dip Li, which is Indonesian long pepper, chilies, and maybe maybe one or two other things. Very, very simple. Malap, a weird little seed that you get. And then, for instance, in Nan, they deep fry all the offal before they put it into the lab. And here they don't. They just boil it. It just, you know, goes on and on. And then there's variations of lab. There's lab dip, which is raw. There's sa, which is a raw meat salad that doesn't get minced super fine. It just gets kind of sliced.
That's my favorite.
Sa. And then, well, there's sa dip, which is raw offal and raw meat mixed together with a similar paste. And to make it even more complex, you know, as you move from region to region, the meaning of sa changes slightly. The meaning, you know, it's super complex. Just that one dish, right?
Well, it sounds like all the different ways you cook, if you're cooking different ingredients different ways and then combining them, it's just layers upon layers upon layers of flavors and textures. Mm-hmm. And I think, I lost my train of thought, but I think, like you said, very complex. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, I'll be talking more to Andy Ricker about cuisine and culture in Thailand.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
All right, we are back. I'm Brianna Kurtz, and you're listening to Native on Heritage Radio. I'm in Chiang Mai with Andy Ricker right now, talking about Thai cuisine and culture. So, picking up where we left off, keeping with the food theme, I have to say I've never seen so much garlic in my entire life than I've seen here. And I've had Thai food in the U.S. You know, there's garlic in it, but it's slivers of garlic, full, whole, raw garlic. They have the little, you know, condiment cup on the table full of just garlic that you can just peel and pop in or just eat. You have kind of the grated garlic raw on top, maybe on like a noodle dish or something. I mean, I've just never seen so much garlic. I don't think I understood how important garlic is here. Mm-hmm. And then I want to ask kind of as a follow-up to one of my questions previously is... it kind of goes both ways with what Thai people expect us to want to eat, but also what they have brought over to the West, and why have those dishes become, why has santan become the national dish that we know in the West, or why sticky rice, or and why lob, like why not other things, why those things?
Well, the last three things you mentioned are relatively recent additions to the Western Thai menu. And initially when people came over to the States, you know, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, there were no Thai ingredients. You know, really they were relying on stuff that they were, you know, bringing, their family was sending them. And then somebody set up a shop in various cities and they'd start importing groceries. But they, you know, they had to import the things that were the easiest to import, you know, because of regulations from the government. So you can only, you know, the big factory stuff. And for price also, you need to get the stuff that's going to be the least expensive. And then as far as raw produce and meat, really the what was there was the Chinese. And, you know, so there was all the Chinese vegetables, all the Chinese cuts of meats. And so initially most of the Thai dishes that you find in the States were of Chinese origin. Now, this opens up a whole other line of conversation. I won't go too far down, but Thai food is tremendously influenced by Chinese food. And there's dishes here that we identify in the West as Thai that are actually, you know, almost 95% Chinese that the Thai have added a little twist to. Mm-hmm. So most of the staples of the Thai menu in the West are Thai Chinese. And, you know, what happened next was the influx of Isan food throughout Thailand. The Isan people are the workforce of Thailand. Mm-hmm. They travel to the city. And so with the spread of Isan food throughout the country, it's been introduced, and you know, Westerners have eaten it here, and we like it. So it's showing up on the menus in the West. And, you know, this recent sort of specialization in Thai food in America is very recent. It's only really within the last 5 to 6 years. With Isan food being the logical first step for specialization. Because a lot of the people who come to work in America, in the kitchen, are Isan people. So that's how, my understanding, anecdotally, I haven't done any scholarly work on this, but that's my understanding from an anecdotal standpoint.
And I wanted to ask you, as far as that food coming over, and as far as kind of, you said, specialization, is there anything happening here in Thailand right now that's going to influence the cuisine of tomorrow here?
Yeah, I think there's several things happening. Like I said before, Thailand is not, it's not a closed, it's not a vacuum. There's influence coming from everywhere. There's a lot of Japanese people here. There's a lot of Korean people here. Thai pop culture is heavily influenced by Korean pop culture and Japanese pop culture. And the food is already affected the cuisine here. So you see these, you'd be driving down the street and you see a giant restaurant with, 300 people sitting in there with a grill on the table. Mm-hmm. Mugatat and suki, wildly popular, nothing to do with Thai food whatsoever. Mm.
Well, in that sense, there is this kind of melting pot happening, mm-hmm. and there's this fusion. I know someone I was speaking to yesterday said her favorite restaurant in Chiang Mai is a Yunnan Chinese restaurant. I'm sure you know it. And that brings up an interesting question that I've observed while traveling through Asia is, people have this kind of idea of street food, mm-hmm. street food culture, but when does street food stop becoming street food and it becomes what we would think of just as a restaurant? Because the food looks like street food. It has all the hallmarks that you would think of about street food, except I'm sitting at a table, someone comes over and gives me a drink, you might order and sit down, and all of a sudden there's this thin, unclear line about when it's street food and when it's not.
Well, the line was drawn by us, and we have decided that certain dishes are street food, and that's not really the case.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, street food is somebody sitting on a corner with a tiny little stand making one dish. That's street food. Roadside and street-side restaurants in Thailand are by far the most popular and common ones. It's to me, that's where a lot of the best food is made. I don't call it street food. To me, street food really is a noodle stand on the side of the road, or a cow gang stall. So we in the West, we're really obsessed with this idea of street food, and we're quick to label anything that isn't served on, a plate with a big bowl of rice and, as street food, which is not true, really, to me. Anyway.
Yeah, I think it's a big fail of the vocabulary, the word street and food, mm-hmm. and the images that conjures up in your mind. But when you're here, when you're traveling, it's just not so clear that it's all street food. I know in many countries that I've been in now, I'm just definitely a lesson learned.
Yeah.
I think for me.
To subvert things even further, a lot of the food that we would consider, like, if I would say a stand on the side of the street is street food, a lot of that food in Thailand is actually a franchise. There'll be a noodle cart sitting there, and it's, one of 5,000 mm-hmm. of the same thing
yeah.
in Thailand. And as a Westerner, you have no way of knowing this. It just looks like a noodle cart. So there's this kind of idea, there's this romantic idea.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That we have about street food in the West that isn't necessarily true here.
Absolutely. Well, I can spend all day talking to you about these topics, but I want to kind of jump back over on the other side of the world. Your Pok Pok Bat Thai just opened in L.A., like, I think, two, three days ago?
Pok Pok Bat Thai opened last week, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But you're here.
Yes.
So that's kind of very uncharacteristic of an owner to not be with its new baby.
Mm-hmm. I'm a victim of circumstance. I mean, basically what happened was we got delayed opening by a month. His trip was already booked. It was an unfortunate chain of events, but we were a day away from opening, and we got stopped from opening, basically. And so we were ready to go. We just hit the pause button.
When was that?
That was December. It was right at the end of November, right?
Wow.
We were supposed to open on December 1st. We ended up opening the 30th. Everybody was trained up, ready to go. Place was stocked, and we had to put the brakes on. And I've got an incredibly... People always ask me, how can you be in Thailand when you've got blah, 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 this many? And it's like, look, any restaurant group of this size, it's not held up by one person. Like I'm not Hercules. I can't do it myself. So, I've got a big team of operations managers, store managers, some of which have been with me for a very long time, all of whom are very, very capable.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows me to travel. You know, frankly, I couldn't do more than two restaurants without that sort of support. And nobody can, really.
Well, I know you've gone through different kind of chapters or phases in your life. You were traveling, and you were a chef, and you were painting. And so is this whole pop-pop thing just another phase?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, I mean, who knows? But I hope that, I don't die working in restaurants, It's a hard life, even at the level that I'm at. At whatever skill level. I mean, at sort of my perspective on everything, kind of hovering above it. It's still a very, very intense lifestyle and hard work. And I don't really have much of a life outside of restaurants, and I'd like to have a life outside of restaurants someday. I wouldn't call it a phase. I mean, I think I've found my calling, if you want to call it that. I can't really imagine anything else that I'm going to be more interested in that I want to make a living from than doing food.
Well, it's kind of kidding, because, I mean, you have, correct me if I'm wrong, is it 9 brick-and-mortar spaces now?
We have 8, and the 9th will be open later this spring.
And you have the book, and
writing
two more.
Yeah,
okay.
We've got another two-book deal coming up with 10 Speed, and the first book will be a Thai drinking food book. It's a kind of a tie-in with Whiskey Soda Lounge.
Well, I'm glad, because let's finish the thought and I'll move on to the next. But and you have products, obviously. Mm-hmm. So what's, besides the books, obviously you just mentioned that, what else, what's next? More pop-pops in different cities, or?
I think that we've got to put a little stop to restaurant expansion. I said that 2 years ago too, but I feel like this LA project is going to be the biggest one yet, and it's going to be a tremendous energy suck. It's going to be a huge economic suck, and frankly, I'm kind of pooped, and I'd like to slow down on that. I'm also concerned about the future of restaurants, given all the changes afoot in labor laws and.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, there's this thing coming down the pike where the minimum wage... Now, mm-hmm. As a caveat, let me say that I'm a bleeding heart liberal, but there's a real problem with the idea of paying a $15 an hour minimum wage to everybody when servers are walking with $200 to $300 in tips a night, and the kitchen isn't allowed to get any tips. That's a huge unfair thing. And I think the problem is a lot, people who are making these rules are painting independent restaurants with the same brush as they're painting McDonald's, which is retarded as far as I'm concerned. There's going to come a point, and this is what happened in the manufacturing world. There came a point when, the cost of paying people to make things became so prohibitively high, and the market would not support the prices people would have to charge to sell their product when things, now it's a disaster. There's no, almost no manufacturing in the United States anymore. It's all moved offshore. You can look at Australia, for an example, where their minimum wage is, I can't remember, it's like $17 or $18 an hour. And, if you work on Sundays, double time. It doesn't matter whether you only work Sundays, it's double time. So, basically restaurants are charging $30 for a hamburger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if things continue to go the way they are in the United States, then there's a very good chance that we're going to end up like Australia in a certain way. I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow, but I think, you know, I look at restaurants as a long-term thing. I don't look at them as, like, open, make all my money in 3 years and then close. I look at it as, you know, a heritage thing. I want restaurant to be around for 10, 15, 20 years. And, you know, what I'm doing right now is trying to find ways to open revenue streams that don't have to do with restaurants, that have to do with manufacturing products or giving services, so that that part of the business can support the restaurant, so we can continue to deliver food for what I think is a fair price and treat our employees well and all that kind of stuff. So.
And I wanted to talk about that as far as the products are concerned. Is that an important component of what Pop-Pop does?
I think it will be. I think that we've established ourselves with the Pok-Pok Song drinking vinegars, yep. And you know we've been at it for a while now. And even though that category in beverages is still considered a bleeding edge category, we're a leader in that, and that doesn't translate to millions of dollars by any means. It's a very small niche market.
But creating that supply chain from source to consumer, I get a sense that is a component of what Pok-Pok does.
Yes.
And that will continue to grow, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. I mean, I just had a meeting yesterday with a guy who's David Thompson's business partner here. David Thompson has a company called Boonswing that does food manufacturing. And we're trying to figure out ways of getting product directly from Thailand, directly to the restaurants, so that we can get high quality ingredients at, you know, the same price that we're paying for inferior quality ingredients in America now. And that's it's difficult. There's a lot of obstacles to it, but you know, ultimately, you know, I'm just really trying to find ways of like balancing quality and cost.
Well, I really hope you succeed in that endeavor, because I know I'm here and I can only fit so many things in my suitcase that I hope I can get through customs when I get home, and I just want to bring everything home. And I know that the finite amount that I do get to get back in the country will probably disappear quickly in my kitchen. So, and also, you know, we need to wrap it up. We're about out of time and you need to head out of town. Where are you going?
I'm going up to Mahong Son, which is on the Burmese border. It's a beautiful little town in the mountains, and really fantastic and interesting food culture there from the Shan people, Thai people. Food that's unlike Thai food, unlike northern Thai food. It's its own deal. It's very, very interesting.
Well, and hopefully we'll be seeing some of those, not recipes, I don't want to call them recipes, but inspirations.
You will, and we've actually already run a couple of the things on the menu in New York, and we'll be doing the same thing again.
Andy, thank you so much for joining me today. Great catching up with you here in Thailand. That's all for Native this week. See you next week, same time, same place, live 11 a.m. every Thursday right here on Heritage Radio. And in the meantime, you can learn more about my trip to Thailand plus other Asian adventures online at BKFAF or my website, briannakurtz.com.
To this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.